welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Over the past several years, a number of new countries have declared themselves democracies, but not all older democracies have greeted this as a positive development. In a moment, Talking History's Terry Clark will examine this phenomenon and the reasons for concern. But first, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. This week in 1981, Walter Cronkite signed off for the last time as anchorman of the CBS Evening News, voted the most trusted public figure in the United States in a public opinion survey in 1973, and hailed by his colleagues as honest, sincere, and very professional, Walter Leland Cronkite Jr. won countless awards for journalistic excellence and built a flawless reputation on honest, objective, straightforward reporting of news events. One of the first journalists accredited to the American Armed Forces after the U.S. entered World War II, Cronkite covered many of the major battles of the war. In order to obtain his widely proclaimed eyewitness accounts, he flew on the first American bombing raids over Germany, parachuted into Holland with the Allied paratroopers, and waded ashore with the troops at Normandy. After joining CBS in 1950, Cronkite headed CBS coverage of the first nationally televised presidential campaign in 1952. 10 years later, he anchored the first broadcast of the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. Over the next 30 years, his confidential delivery of carefully written, objective, and easily understandable news reports won plaudits from colleagues. A trusted paternal figure and a reassuring bedrock of stability in a troubled and rapidly changing world, Cronkite entered millions of Americans' living rooms in what became a nightly ritual of turning on the TV to the CBS Evening News. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, since Veterans Day 2000, the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress has been in the planning phase of a veterans oral history project that will collect and preserve the personal experience, stories, and oral histories of American war veterans and make them available to the public over the Internet. The designers of the project encourage veterans, their families, veterans organizations, and students to audio and videotape veterans' memories and submit them to the project for public access. More than 19 million war veterans are living in the U.S. today, but almost 1,500 die each day, which makes the Oral History Project a critical, urgent task in preserving an important part of our history. The Library of Congress has made available for research microfilm copies of the records of the Communist Party of the USA, covering the period from the 1920s through the 1940s. Long thought to have been destroyed, this collection of documents was discovered to have been secretly shipped to the Soviet Union over 50 years ago and kept in a closed Communist Party archive until the post-Soviet Russian government opened them for research and agreed to have the Library of Congress copy them. This is Talking History. It has been called the third wave, or the third movement of a relatively large number of countries into the fold of the world's democracies. The movement, however, has been based on those countries' self-assessment of their supposed democratic institutions, which has generated considerable controversy. Talking History's Terry Clark takes up that controversy in his conversation this week with Larry Diamond.
In recent years, scholars and statesmen have increasingly focused on a wave of countries declaring themselves to be democracies. While many view the phenomenon as a positive development, some have expressed concerns about the quality of these new democracies. Here to offer us his perspective on the so-called third wave of democratization is Professor Larry Diamond. Professor Diamond is a senior research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institute. He is the author of the book, Developing Democracy, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Welcome to our show, Professor Diamond.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Professor Diamond, just exactly what is this third wave that people are talking about?
The third wave is the third global wave of transitions to democracy. There have been two previous waves. The second wave of democracy began after World War II and ended with many democratic breakdowns and military coups in 1960s and early 70s. And then the third wave of democratization began with the overthrow of the dictatorship in Portugal in April of 1974 and the transition to democracy there, then in Spain, then in Greece. Then this wave of global democratization spread to Latin America. Then it spread to East Asia with the People's Revolution in the Philippines, overthrowing Ferdinand Marcos, transitions to democracy in Taiwan, Korea, Thailand. Then the wave spread to post-communist Europe with the collapse of the Berlin Wall and then the Soviet Union. And around that time, a new wave of democratic transitions was ignited in Africa. So this has become a global wave in which now it is estimated by Freedom House in New York, more than 60% of all of the states in the world are electoral democracies. That means they choose their national leaders through free, fair, and competitive elections.
You mentioned a little bit about a second wave that occurred after World War II. What about the first wave? When did that occur, and when did it, I guess it must have ended at some point.
The first wave was a very, according to Sam Huntington, the author of this book with this title, The Third Wave, the first wave began as a very long wave of democratic expansion through the 19th century, picked up momentum in the early 20th century, but collapsed during the Depression in the interwar period with many breakdowns in Europe and in Latin America. So we've had two waves of democratic expansion, three waves of democratic expansion. Each of the previous two waves has been followed by a period of what Huntington calls a reverse wave, where the breakdowns of democracy were many greater in number than the transitions to democracy. We have many new, many fragile, many not very well-functioning democracies in the world. And the question we face now is whether we can avoid a third reverse wave of democratic breakdowns.
What is the cause of this wave now? Why are we having this third wave?
Well, there are many different causes. The economic failures of authoritarian rule, the role of religious organizations, the Catholic Church played a very important role in Latin America, in the Philippines, in Poland. The role of international actors, the United States and the European Union, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, are much more assertive now in demanding good governance and in supporting democratic development and supporting Democrats in other countries than ever before. We give very substantial assistance now for free and fair elections, for human rights groups, for independent press, and so on, through our foreign aid program, through the Agency for International Development, and through a particular organization that we have for this purpose, which is funded by Congress in part, but which is a non-governmental organization called the National Endowment for Democracy. And these groups have been very active in supporting grassroots organizations pushing for democracy, human rights, transparency, and the rule of law in many of these countries.
Your thesis seems to be that the international climate is ripe for democratization at this point. Are there any internal factors that might make it more likely that a country will attempt a democratization effort in the middle of this third wave?
Well, there are several types of factors internally that encourage democratization. One is success of authoritarian rule, economic development, as in Korea and Taiwan, giving rise to a larger middle class that's more independent of the state. Another is the failure of authoritarian rule in Indonesia, as I said, with Marcos in the Philippines, with many of the dictatorships in Latin America, with virtually every authoritarian regime in Africa, and with the Soviet states, where the economic, social, moral, and political failures of authoritarian rule were so massive that the people really were hungering for a different type of regime. But another factor domestically that's very important is having an opposition that is vigorous and united. And when you see trade union leaders, civic leaders, religious leaders, human rights leaders, student leaders, breaking away from state control and coming together in a very broad front for fundamental democratic change, that's when authoritarian rulers have to start worrying. And that's why Robert Mugabe is so worried now in Zimbabwe and is trying to play the race card to divert attention from the failures of his rule, because this very broad democratic front has taken shape in Zimbabwe.
What about, say, the People's Republic of China? We see any possibility here?
I think the best prospect for democracy in mainland China is economic development and social change that creates a more autonomous middle class that demands more freedom. And my own view is that the regime is not going to collapse anytime soon. You're not going to have a Soviet-style breakdown anytime soon. And so the best way for us to foster political change in China is through globalization, trade liberalization, engagement, opening up flows of information, and encouraging China to move toward a rule of law with an independent judiciary and transparency in the way that government rules are made and enforced. And I think there is a growing movement within China, even within the Chinese Communist Party, for this type of at least liberalization of their regime.
There's been some debate, or at least a debate that I've heard among scholars on the difference between a procedural and a substantive democracy. What are the issues in this debate?
Well, as you noted at the start of our conversation and introducing me, there have been many new democracies created, dozens of them since 1974. Many of them have the formal procedures of electoral democracy. They have competitive elections, which are maybe not perfectly free and fair, but substantially so. And they can change their leaders. But in many of these countries, from Russia, if you can still call it a democracy, to Turkey, to parts of Latin America and South Asia and elsewhere, elections take place in a context where there's substantial political violence, widespread abuses of human rights, massive corruption, executive domination of the legislature, and having the political substance of democracy means moving toward the constitutional guarantees for due process, for accountability, for restraint of executive power, for an independent judiciary, control of corruption, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of organization, and so on, so that you have really liberty and accountability and responsiveness going along with electoral choice. That doesn't happen automatically.
Now, you're among those who's most frequently cited as having some concerns with the third wave. What are these concerns that you have that you've stated, or what are your concerns?
Well, my concerns are that because many of these democracies that have come into being, and some that have been around for several decades, like Venezuela and Colombia, and Sri Lanka, which is in the midst of a terrible civil war, because they're functioning so poorly, democracy is losing support among the people. And the functioning of democracy is under great pressure. And in one of the countries where this decay was most advanced, and where democracy was most corrupt and poorly functioning, we actually saw a military coup overthrowing democracy in October of 1999. This was in Pakistan. We've come close to overt military intervention in Turkey in the past, and the military exercises a great deal of power behind the scenes in Turkey. We have a state that is really in crisis in Colombia. We have an elected leader, the former leader of a military coup attempt in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, who's gradually acquiring more and more political power so that it's hard to know if the system is still democratic. We have all these systems under stress, and I think that if we don't improve this political substance of democracy, the functioning, the quality and integrity of the functioning of democracy, and if we don't see these countries making needed economic reforms, both to generate economic growth and open up markets, and also to distribute wealth and income more equitably so that people have a stake in the system, we are in danger of seeing a third reverse wave of democratic breakdowns. This is a very important time to be asking this question because we have a new administration coming in the United States. One thing that the Clinton administration did do was maintain a very strong commitment to promotion of democracy around the world. And it's very important that the Bush administration that's coming in sustain that commitment and sustain both the symbols of American support for democratic freedom and vitality around the world and sustain the aid programs that are helping to support this and keep on the diplomatic pressure on these countries to observe democratic principles and procedures.
You know, I've heard some scholars also discuss this issue of democratization, and I'm listening to you, and you're talking at once about the people losing confidence, and at the same time you're talking about the actions of political elites. Which is more important here? Can the people in losing hope foster change that might lead to a democracy, or do we pin most of our hopes on some sort of a democratic elite or series of elite choices that ultimately lead to democracy?
Both are very important. If elites don't make the right choices and if they're not committed to democracy, it's very hard to sustain it. On the other hand, that isn't enough. You need a you need a broad civic commitment on the part of the citizens as well. So really, both are important.
What about your prognosis of the future? What are we going to see? The third wave continue, or do you think we'll see a reversal?
I think I'm not without hope. I'm not a pessimist, but my feeling is we are at a point where democracy is very finely perched, where things could go either way. And I think it's really a very fluid and formative moment. So it's a moment where I think it's very important that the United States, the European Union, international and regional organizations maintain this steadfast commitment both at the level of symbolism and rhetoric and at the level of diplomatic policies and aid policies so that we link up with the pressures inside of these societies for better and more democratic governance. I think if we keep our focus, if we keep our engagement, that we can gradually nurture and support better, more liberal, more accountable, and democratic governance in these countries. But if we let up or pursue more cynical priorities, I think we could be on the edge of a real implosion.
Professor Diamond, I thank you very much for being our guest today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Professor Larry Diamond, a senior research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institute. He's the author of the book, Developing Democracy, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press.
We celebrate International Women's Day this week and Women's History Month in March. To mark both events, we asked Susan Ware, a professor of history at Harvard University, to give us her list of the 20th century's most influential women. Professor Ware is the author of Letter to the World, Seven Women Who Shaped the American Century, and Still Missing, Amelia Earhart and the Search for Modern Feminism.
Choosing the 20th century's most influential women. What a daunting task. And yet what testimony to the enormous contributions that women have made to the United States and to the world over the past 100 years. The place to start is easy. Eleanor Roosevelt. No other woman, and few men, have had the wide-ranging influence on their times that Eleanor Roosevelt did, first during her husband's 4 terms as president, and then as the unofficial First Lady of the world until her death in 1962. In sharp contrast to the plummeting statures of most political figures, past and present, Eleanor Roosevelt's reputation continues to rise, 4 decades now after her death. Eleanor Roosevelt symbolized a spirit of public-spirited womanhood, which is an essential aspect of 20th century American history. She exercised her influence through politics and international affairs, but many other women have excelled in their chosen fields. Think of Margaret Sanger, leading the fight for women's right to birth control information. Rachel Carson, setting the agenda for the modern environmental movement with her path-breaking book, Silent Spring, in 1962. Martha Graham, founding the field of modern dance. Amelia Earhart, soaring in her airplane across the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, taking women's aspirations soaring with her. And not to forget civil rights pioneers like Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Rosa Parks, who remind us that the struggle for equality, perhaps the 20th century's most far-reaching social movement, was not just led by men. In fact, each major area of modern American life counts women leaders and pioneers. Mary Pickford and Lillian Gish in the early years of Hollywood, Babe Dietrichson Zaharias in sports, perhaps the best all-around athlete, male or female, the century has ever known. The glorious voices of Marian Anderson, Ella Fitzgerald, and Sarah Vaughan in music. Strong-minded women like Emma Goldman and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn in the field of labor and radicalism. Cosmetics pioneer Helena Rubinstein in the realm of business. The list could go on and on. And that is the significance of drawing up symbolic lists like these during Women's History Month. The awareness of how vital, how central women have been to many of the major developments of the last 100 years. Eleanor Roosevelt led the way, but she was not alone. She had plenty of company.
You've been listening to Professor Susan Ware, who is currently editing the 5th volume of Notable American Women and writing a biography of radio talk show pioneer Mary Margaret McBride. This is Talking History. As we just heard, Professor Susan Ware chose Eleanor Roosevelt as the most influential woman of the 20th century. For our site of the week, we have chosen a National Historic Site dedicated to Roosevelt's memory. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Eleanor Roosevelt once said, "The greatest thing I have learned is how good it is to come home again." That simple statement expressed her love for her modest house near the Hudson River in Hyde Park, New York. Known as Valkill Cottage, it was the only home that was hers and is the only historic site dedicated to a First Lady. Guided tours of the cottage are offered with program themes varying from her political activities and personal challenges to her international diplomatic efforts. Visitors are free to roam the 180 acres that include a rose garden, a cutting garden, pond, and trails. Other activities include bird and wildlife watching, as well as fishing and nature walks. The site is open year-round.
Turning to our list of coming attractions, we have 2 programs to report on this week, both to air on PBS during the next few weeks. Groucho, A Life in Review, will air on March 12th. Rather than being a PBS original, it brings to television the award-winning stage production that highlights the legendary comedian's life and career. The show takes viewers through Groucho's life from 15 to 85, As the young vaudevillian, the Broadway and film star, the irrepressible host of radio and television's You Bet Your Life, and the reflective octogenarian in his final years. On March 20th, watch for Search for the Battleship Bismarck. Almost a half century ago, Germany unleashed the dreaded warship Bismarck on the North Atlantic. Its mission was to put a stranglehold on the Allied shipping routes. Within a week, the Bismarck sank the pride of Britain, the Hood, and Winston Churchill ordered the German menace sunk. In one of the great naval battles of World War II, the British Navy did just that, and after 2 years of searching, undersea explorer Robert Ballard has found the vessel at the bottom of the Atlantic, some 600 miles off the coast of France. Search for the Battleship Bismarck tells the story of Ballard's discovery. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of these PBS programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you will join us next time when we'll take a look at the man many historians consider to be the father of the United States Constitution, James Madison. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.